Hello, welcome to BitNote. This is David Collins and we'll be talking about video games and playing video game music. Hope you enjoy. All right, let's start this off with the music track from a game that's a shining example of its genre. The music plays over a very energetic animated cutscene that brings us into the world of the game at the beginning. It's good stuff.
Thank you.
And that was from the intro and opening of Day of the Tentacle, developed by LucasArts and composed, in that case, by Clint Bezhakian, Peter McConnell and Michael Land. And, of course, we've played some music by Michael Land before over here, notably the Monkey Island theme tunes. Day of the Tentacle is seen by some, and it's hard for me to, you know, whenever it comes to, like, the best of anything, I'm always very hesitant to judge, because you could say, oh, this game's the best, but it could, like, there could be another game that may not be quite as good, but have a lot of characters that you'd, or aspects to it that you'd still love, and you feel that the best game ever doesn't. But the point is, a lot have said that Day of the Tentacle is one of the greatest adventure games of all time, and to be honest, I can completely see where they're coming from. It's technically a sequel to Manic Mansion, which was released several years earlier, and which itself was one of the earlier point-and-click adventure games. The thing with Day of the Tentacle is, essentially, it's just a living world. It's all cartoony, it's all very, very vivid, very energetic, and it's got a great sense of humor, too, and the puzzles are actually clever. Let me set it up for you. Essentially what happens is in the first Day of the Tentacle, it was kind of like a rip-off, well, you know, an inspired by a B-movie thing. You know, there's a house with mad scientists in it doing evil things, and there's a meteor, and then you got a group of teenagers, and you move them into the house one by one and try to deal with the horrors inside, and hopefully they won't get killed in the process and end up with gravestones. Maniac Mansion was actually a fun game. That was the original. It was, in a lot of ways, it pioneered a lot of the aspects that we associate with point-and-click adventure games. In these sort of games, basically, you're using the mouse pretty much the whole time, and, you know, it's not really joysticks or anything. You're given an environment, and you have to click around, you have to move your characters, pick up items, see what, talk to other characters, try to figure things out. A lot of games, of course, are just about defeating the enemies, but that's where adventure games were different. They were about setting up stories and worlds, and you had to, like, figure things out, talk, interact, and just, you know, bring things forward to your conclusion. Now, a lot of times, this would obviously treat you to a lot of different skill sets. You know, it wasn't just a case of, you know, learn one single pattern. You had to quickly evaluate each circumstance as it came and try to figure out what the best course of action was. Especially early games like Maniac Mansion, which actually were kind of unfair. I mean, doing things that you weren't quite sure of could end up getting your character imprisoned or, unfortunately, killed. At the same time, there were a lot of very, very obvious things you could do that would get your character killed or otherwise, or imprisoned, which actually added more of the fun, because there's nothing beats the idea of doing something in a video game, knowing it's an incredibly stupid thing to do, and suddenly finding out, okay, that's exactly why it was such a stupid thing. It works because if you do something screwed up in a game, but you can, and it screws you over, but you clearly know why, that's a great feeling. It just, because, you know, I'll learn next time. But with these adventure games, whether Monkey Island, of course, was a classic example of these sort of games which LucasArts developed, that one was pirate-themed, you basically interact with the scenario, and it was all about the world that the adventure game was set in. And it would be up to the developers of the game to try to figure out what circumstance you're in, what puzzles would you have to solve, what is in the way of you trying to achieve your goal, and how do you get through those obstacles. And that was the whole challenge, because the same method wouldn't keep working most of the time. And you had to be observant, you had to look around, you had to pick up various items, and you had to try to understand how the game world worked. Day of the Tentacle is, like I said, one of the best examples of that. For a start, there's the production values. I mean, you've got a full animated intro cutscene, which is great. You've got great music, as you've heard from Michael Land. You've got full voice acting, and this was back in the 90s, so voice acting was just pretty new at the time. And so, you know, visuals, aesthetics, and the script was good. So, but what pushed it over the edge, though? Because you can have good productions in a game, and it's still not that good. Well, what pushed it over the edge was it invited you into it, and it had good characters, good humor, great writing, and you actually made progress. You could use your brain and figure things out. The plot line, which is also pretty crazy, is essentially one of the guys who was originally in the first game ends up returning to the mansion, which, of course, in the previous game had been sort of all these sci-fi, meteorite, alien shenanigans which they had to deal with, and because apparently two tentacles, two of the characters in this game are actually tentacles, literally. That's why it's called Day of the Tentacle, because as well as being a kind of a bit of a B-movie nod, once again, this is literally about tentacles trying to take over the world. Well, actually, they're one tentacle in particular trying to take over the world. I remember when I was in school and people explained this to me and I was going, what? But the point is, So you go up to the mansion, you find the scientist and some of the characters in the previous game, and you try to figure out, okay, how do I put a stop to this? Of course, in the course of trying to put a stop to this, you end up all your three characters end up traveling through time. One ends up 200 years in the past, the other 200 years in the future, and the remaining character remains stuck in the present day, which is obviously the most boring. And so then you basically, at first your character's a bit stuck, but as you progress in the game, you start to realize, okay, in the future, you realize the tentacles do take over the world, and suddenly there's a whole civilization that's been devoted towards, based on the tentacles and the subjugation of the human race. In the ancient past, you're walking around just when the continent of America was being formed, so you're meeting all these historical figures like George Washington and Ben Franklin. And it's pretty crazy, because it's actually almost historically educational. Well, okay, that's pushing it extremely far, but about as historically educational as maybe an Animaniacs episode. In fact, that's quite a good guide. I mean, it had that sort of zany humor, sort of over-the-top cartoonist, but it was taking its inspiration from real historical events, which ended up making it all the more interesting. And so, essentially, all three of you, you know, you switch between the characters as they gradually become freed, have to work together to try to figure out, how do we put an end to this, how do we stop the future from happening, how do we prevent the tentacles from taking over? And also, it's also about how do we all get back into the present time, because a lot of the game is just you, the various characters, working their way through the scenarios and trying to get access to the machine that'll bring them back. And so, obviously, it's also done very cleverly. There's a couple of nice little puzzles, you know, about if you put something in the past, can you get it in the present or in the future? If you put something in the present, can you get it in the future? There's a lot of really nice little nods and puzzles. And I suppose the puzzle solving as well. I mean, when we talk about adventure games and puzzle solving, they almost seem like disparate elements. It's like there is the adventure game with the adventure and story and plot, and then there are the puzzles. And in a bad adventure game, there will always be a clear distinction between one or the other. The puzzles will always seem arbitrary. For instance, maybe you want to walk into a room, but the door is locked. And instead of having to, you know, just ask for someone to unlock it or knock on the door and see if it comes, you always have to come up with some elaborate contraption of pushing a sheet of paper under the door and poking the key out of the lock with a pencil, and then pulling the key back in and the key unlocking the door. I mean, that's an okay example, but it can get a lot more obscure. And sometimes, the problem is sometimes the program will have a puzzle in their head, but when it gets to the game, people are going, wait, how am I meant to even guess this? But the great thing with Day of the Tentacle is that, for a start, you could sort of figure out a lot of the puzzles easily. In fact, a lot of times I solved some puzzles before I even knew they were there. But they also had a degree of logic to it. That is the best sense of puzzle solving an adventure game, where you look at the scenario, where you think logically, you think, you know, what would I really do if I was genuinely in this situation? And suddenly an idea comes to you, and you try it out, and it works. I mean, it is amazing when that works. And that's why it's kind of sad that, you know, that a lot of people don't have the patience for some of these puzzles, because they're saying, I can't solve it. But I mean, like, the kick you get, no matter how hard a puzzle is, the kick you get when you suddenly finally snaps in your mind and figure out, that's great. I mean, it's actually one thing, I don't like looking at walkthroughs. There was one puzzle in Day of the Tentacle that I couldn't figure out it myself, and when I looked it up in a walkthrough after, you know, so much agony trying to figure it out, I actually felt disappointed, because I said, you know what, I should have figured that one out. Okay, I mean, given the context, given the world, given the atmosphere, given what I know and the game's inspirations, I should have figured out that was the best course of action. But well, there's no real point getting caught. I could throw the defense that maybe the game wasn't quite as clear as it could have been, but well. Oh, boy. Day of the Tentacle. Adventure games, like I said, point-and-click adventure games, great genre. LucasArts, of course, which some people tend to know more for George Lucas and Star Wars and stuff like that. LucasArts had a huge run of really successful adventure games, beginning with Maniac Mansion in the 80s, going through to Monkey Island, Grim Fandango did Tentacle. It kind of came to an end with Full Throttle in about 1999, and it came to a definite end when they cancelled the Sam & Max. The new Sam & Max. They actually made a Sam & Max game in the early 90s, but they were about to make a new one, cancelled it, and LucasArts wasn't the same since. Although they've recently started realizing their adventure games are good and re-released, you know, deluxe versions of earlier games. But, yeah, it's just, I mean, like I said, adventure games can be great, and Data Tentacle was a great example of one of them. You know, I've got another track from another favourite adventure game series of mine, but I think I'll save it for the next episode. It's definitely a different take on the adventure game genre. You see, after LucasArts stopped doing adventure games in the end of the 90s, a lot of other companies stopped doing adventure games too, but they didn't die out, and that's something I think I'll talk about a little bit more about next episode. In the meantime, I'm going to play a different opening song, and it is a somewhat infamous opening song. It is not from the video game Infamous, I might add, or its sequel Infamous 2. Rather, it starts when the video game starts, and a lot of game magazines and other game communities have said that this possibly isn't quite the best video game intro music ever created. It plays at the beginning of the song, and much like the previous one, it also had that full intro sequence with a bunch of animated characters and doing stuff. This one's more like a music video rather than being the background music to a bunch of cutscenes that are happening. But, look, this doesn't really deserve it. Let's just play it.
Here we go.
So the finally here. Performance for you. If you know the words, you can join in too. Put your hands together if you wanna clap. As we take you through this monkey rap.
He's game. Monkey Kong.
He's the leader of the bunch. You know him well. He's finally back to kick some tail.
Okay, how did you feel about listening to that little number? As you can see, it's not just an intro music, it's also a basic overview of the playable characters that are in this game. It is from Donkey Kong 64 for the Nintendo 64, because obviously 64 was a bit of a name that they used for a bit there. It was composed by Grant Kerr Hope, a British composer from Rare, and the game was developed by Rare. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's actually, I kind of like that tune. Okay, I know it's I like it for the wrong reasons, but I mean, it's kind of nice that they'd make a song like that. Essentially, Donkey Kong 64, as you may or may not be aware, Donkey Kong is a hugely long-run franchise. I mean, you know the way that Mario, you know, Mario, the iconic game character, his first appearance was in a Donkey Kong game that was literally called Donkey Kong. And yes, it's basically in that game, in the first Donkey Kong game, you were basically a Mario who was then called Jumpman, and then you were climbing up these ladders to rescue your princess who was being held captive by a great big gorilla. And as you can see, Donkey Kong, you know, King Kong, oh yes, I see the connection. As for why it's called Donkey Kong rather than Monkey Kong, I don't know. When I was young, I heard this whole lot of rumors that it was just a mistake on the fax machine, but I've heard a lot of contradictory stuff since then, and the internet hasn't helped much, so I'm just going to say I don't know. But, so that was Donkey Kong. It had a few sequels, and that was okay. Then in the 90s, for the Super Nintendo, they had this thing. They had a bit of a revival, Donkey Kong Country, which was basically these great pre-rendered, gorgeously look. And actually, that had good music. Maybe I should actually play music from that game instead of this one. But that was really successful. The graphics were great for the time. It was one of the first ones to use pre-rendered graphics, which basically meant that they looked really, really good. And then we had Donkey Kong 64. This was like a very early like 3D platformer. So you had the great big 3D world, you had bright and colourful environments, and you set a character that you moved around and accomplished various goals. As you can see, you had a couple of different characters. You know, they each had one of different abilities, as the song made was at pains to point out to you. And basically, so some characters could go through some areas and others couldn't, and some could use certain abilities, so you'd switch between the characters and it would be a bit of fun. And also, there were certain coins which you could collect, and like each character had their own color, and each coin could only be collected by a color of the same character, and that was actually kind of annoying. You see, this whole thing about switching characters, that's cool, but this game would only let you switch them at specific points. So if you went up to an area and found only this character can get through that point, you had to go back to it, switch the character, and move it back. And that's actually what put me off the game. I mean, it was fun. I mean, I played around and It was great having them jump around a bit, although I tend to have this slightly compulsive thing where if there are too many things you have to collect in a game, I suddenly get demented on collecting them all and then end up burning myself out trying to collect every little last coin and then realizing that I'm not actually enjoying the game itself. But it was still quite a fun game. It was response, you know, and of course with the whole thing of having to go back and forth as different characters, it only made that slightly worse. But it was still a good game, and there was still, like I said, good environments, a couple of different abilities, different challenges and stuff. And maybe it wasn't one of my favorite games, but I felt that song. Maybe I just decided that song was worthy of a greater audience. Yeah. I don't know. There really were songs out there. I think it's like a lot of things. Something gets popular in a major product that people pay attention to, and they're just really willing to just take the piss out of it. If I ever finish Gears of War, I hear that there's another rap song at the end of that one. But yeah, I think I got bored of that game pretty quickly. Look, there's nothing specifically wrong with Gears of War. I just stopped liking it. Anyway. So, what game shall we use to cap everything off? Well, I'm going to play something from G-Lock Air Battle for the Game Gear, which was developed by Sega, and I'm playing the ending theme by Tyrna. Now, G-Lock is basically a set of jet fighters. A lot of people may be more familiar with Afterburner, also developed by Sega, an Afterburner 2. G-Lock was kind of a sequel to that, and G-Lock got ported to a lot of different platforms, of which I really only played one. Now, before you write this thing off, G-Lock had a pretty big amount of power slightly outside of the Game Gear and a few consoles. It had something called the OR 360 Arcade Cabinet. Now, let me just set this up for you. G-Lock is a jet fighter game, okay? The objective is pretty simple. You shoot forward on a jet fighter, and you shoot all the enemies you see. A lot of times it's airplanes. In this specific Game Gear version, they can be battleships and sometimes tanks and bases. But here's the thing, though. The OR 360, and by the way, this is long, no relation to the Xbox 360, this is long before. The OR 360 arcade cabinet was a cabinet that could actually turn you upside down. You would literally get in there, there'd be an attendant, you would step into it, sit down, a harness would go across you, seatbelt buckles, it was like a roller coaster, and when you started playing that thing, the whole thing would spin and turn and fly completely upside down, and boy, I mean, you know, what other game does that? I mean, I could barely keep track of what was going on. I was just trying to fight and shoot and fire wild shots and stuff, and it was just, and the whole thing would spin and turn, and then I just realized, okay, screw trying to actually win the game. I just want to keep doing, you know, loop the loops or spiral rolls just so I could keep getting this thing spinning. I would just spin and turn, and whoa, oh boy, it was just like completely upside down, throwing your perspective off. Oh boy. It was an amazing arcade cabinet. Only Sega. Sega were like the arcade guys. I mean, well, okay, there were a lot of other arcade guys. But Sega coming out with this whole thing that you could turn upside down. Oh, boy. And, you know, even when I played it, I really only played it once. But even when I was noticing, I realized, you know, this is kind of a hard sell. Because, I mean, it's an awesome thing. But you have to, like, for a start, you have to have an attendant, employ an attendant around it just to make sure that people don't accidentally put their hands in the gears and hurt themselves. Although I do hear it had a lot of safety precautions in that respect. But, I mean, come on. I mean, that's what arcades were like back then. I mean, you need to remember, arcades, there was a time when to play the latest video games, you had to go to an arcade. So that was the strong as it took off. But in the 90s, a lot of consoles came around and suddenly people were playing them instead. And so arcades had to do something to up the ante. I mean, I played a game a while back from something that that was actually a bicycle, effectively, air prop or something game. And that's another example. They came up with a lot of different things. I think some people thought they'd move into virtual reality at some stage. And, you know, with headsets. And I actually did play some arcades. So that was really a cool thing. Arcades were really striving forward to come up with all these technology and peripherals that would really engage the people. And, I mean, in the end, I mean, you can almost see the consoles have caught up in some respects with motion sensing and stuff. But, I mean, like, for instance, I remember a police game that had, like, that detected your motions, like, years before then. And another samurai game that had detected you swing the sword. I mean, the arcades were just great for just moving forward with this hardware innovation. But to go back to G-Lock, I mean, aside from having great arcade versions, I really enjoyed the Game Gear version. You could basically, it was pretty simple, it's pretty straightforward. I liked the music too. You basically moved it, you moved over terrain and then you might have to shoot some land targets, then you have to shoot these aircraft in front of you. You tended to have just two things, lock-on missiles and also machine gun fire. Now, I know that the machine gun fire was meant to be firing tracer bullets, but they always looked like potatoes to me for some reason. And the name G-Lock, by the way, stands for G-Force Caused Loss of Consciousness, which basically means you lose, this is a real thing. If jet fighters move too fast, the gravity, the G-Force could take the blood from the brain and cause them to become unconscious or lose focus. And obviously that's why a lot of jet fighter pilots have a lot of inflatable bags that try to basically strangle them, like a tourniquet in some respect, trying to keep the blood in the right parts of their body. But I always found G-Lock a fun game. It was one of those games you sort of picked up and you enjoyed flying through and shooting the things and listening to the nice music and everything. And what you're about to hear is music from the very end of the game. It's when you finally manage to defeat all the main peripheral things, and then you go to the final mission, which is to defeat 5 bases. You know, up to then you'd be shooting aircraft, tanks, and battleships. Now it's the bases. You finally do it, and then you've completed the game. You fly off and land in the aircraft carrier. Listen, this has been David Collins with BitNote. I'm about to play the ending theme to G-Lock Air Battle for the Game Gear, developed by Sega. Thank you for listening.